I want to start with two things from the coming week's Sedra, and then hopefully there'll be some time left, something about Elul and preparation for Rosh Hashanah. Okay, the first thing is the following. Right away in the beginning of the Sedra, we have the Parsha Vidui Meiser. Explain very quickly what Vidui Meiser is. The cycle of giving Meiser, it has 3 year cycles. There's 7 years in a Shemitah. 6 of those years you give Meiser, and the 7th year is Shemitah and you don't give Meiser. The cycle goes like this. The first 2 years of the cycle, in other words, the year after Shemitah and the year after that, you take off 2 Meisers. Meiser Rishon goes to the Levi, 1/10 of your crop goes to the Levi, and the 2/10 you separate and you have to bring it to Yerushalayim, or you redeem it and bring the money to Yerushalayim and eat it in Yerushalayim, or eat the what you buy with the money that you exchange it for. That's the first 2 years of the Shemitah cycle. The third year, you exchange Meiser Sheni for Meiser Ani. You give the first 1/10 to the Levi, and the 2/10, instead of bringing it to Yerushalayim and eating it, you give it to the poor. The 2/10. Okay. Then the 4th year goes back to like the first year, and the 5th year like the 2nd year, Meiser Rishon and Meiser Sheni. And the 3rd year, the 6th year is like the 3rd year, Meiser Rishon and Meiser Ani. And the 7th year, Shemitah, there is no Meiser. No Meiser. Okay, the Torah says that at the end of the 3 year cycle, there's 2 3-year cycles in a Shemitah, at the end of the 3 year cycle, in the 4th year on Pesach, the Erev, the last day of Pesach, you have to make sure that all the Meiser and all the Truma and everything you have to give has been given out. You have 3 years to take care of it. Okay? Each year you have to take care of that year, but you can store it up. You can put it in your silo and not give it out. But by the Erev Yom Tov Achron of Pesach, of the 4th year, you have to make sure that everything is taken care of. And if you do take care of everything properly, then you come to the Beis HaMikdash on Erev Pesach, of Erev Yom Tov Achron of Pesach, of the 4th and 6th year, 4th and 7th year, and you make the following declaration. Biarti HaKodesh Min HaBayis, I have removed all of the holy objects from the house, known as Truma and Meiser, and I gave it to whom it's supposed to be given. The Truma to the Kohen, and the Meiser Rishon to the Levi, and the Meiser Sheni I brought to Yerushalayim and ate it there, and the Meiser Oni I gave to the poor people. I took care of everything. Lo Avarti Mitzvosecha, I haven't done anything wrong, and I didn't forget anything. And then we ask God, we did our part, now you do your part and bless the Jewish people and give us an abundance of crops. That is called Vidui Meiser. Now the word Vidui usually means a confession. Confession usually means I confess I did something wrong. So the obvious question is, why is this called Vidui? I'm saying, God, I did everything right, I didn't do anything wrong, I didn't forget anything. Right, and I am confessing to the fact that I'm a tzaddik. What kind of confession is that? Imagine coming Yom Kippur, and comes time for the vidui. Instead of clapping on your heart, you say, Rabbanu Shalom, I looked over the whole year, didn't do anything wrong, didn't forget anything, did everything right, I confess, I'm a tzaddik. What kind of confession is that? It's a declaration, but it's not a confession. So why is it called vidui meiser? That's the question. The Svarno says a very, very interesting idea. He says like this. He said, had it not been for the sin of the golden calf, then we wouldn't have to give things to the Kohen and to the Levi. We'd all be Kohanim and Levim. Every Jew, even though the firstborn were the ones who would have made the sacrifices, but not only the firstborns, every Jew would have been fit to do what the Kohanim and Levim do. Why were the Kohanim and Levim chosen in place of regular Jews? Because of the sin of the golden calf. Because all the tribes sinned except for Levi. So Levi were then chosen to be the ministers to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, to be the go-betweens between the Jewish people and God, Kohen and Levi. Had it not been for the sin of the golden calf, we all would have been fit to be Kohanim and Levim. There wouldn't be any special tribe. It would have been everybody would have had that same status. And therefore, we would have been able to eat Truma and Maaser. We wouldn't have to give it to anybody else. That's the confession. Ribbono shel Olam, I admit, I had to take these holy objects, this holy food out of my house, because my ancestors sinned, and they caused me not to be a Kohen or a Levi, right, but to be a regular Jew. And I have to give these things to the Kohanim and Levim, and I confess the sin of my ancestors. Now, I didn't sin. I didn't do anything with the golden calf. It's been thousands of years ago. So where's the confession? Now, the idea is, sin doesn't only mean that you've done something wrong. But sin, the word chet, means chisara, something's missing. I admit, Ribbono shel Olam, don't have the level of perfection we could have had that sin not been done years and years ago. So I'm confessing to the fact of my imperfection. That's the idea. I'm not sinning I did something wrong, but I'm sinning that because thousands of years ago my ancestor did something wrong, it left a blemish on the Jewish people for all history. And I confess that I'm imperfect because of that, and I have to give away my Truman Meiser to a Kohen or Levi. I can't keep it for myself, because I could have been a Kohen or Levi. So that is called Vidui Meiser. I'm confessing to my imperfection of because of something that was caused thousands of years ago. That's as far now. I heard in the name of Rabbi Yashaber Soloveitchik Zatzal from Yeshiva University a different idea. What we say in this declaration is the following. Biarti HaKodesh min HaBayis. I've removed all of the holy food from the house. And I've given it. Gam Nesativ LaLevi LaGer LaYosum LaMon. I gave it to whoever it's supposed to be given to. Lo Avarti Mesosecha. I didn't do anything wrong in giving it out. Velo shochachti, I didn't forget anything. Osisi, I did kechol asher tzivisoni, like you told me to do. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, it doesn't say osisi kol asher tzivisoni. I did everything you told me to do. It says osisi kechol, like everything. Meaning, I did it all, but not exactly the way you wanted. Right? I didn't have the exact good intention that I was supposed to have. I did it 99%, 98, nothing wrong, but not exactly as you would have wanted it. I admit that even though I'm making that declaration that I didn't forget anything and I didn't do anything wrong and I did everything right, but I didn't do it exactly as you had wanted. It wasn't exactly, maybe in quantity or quality, exactly what you said. So that's the confession. I'm confessing it was only kichol, about what you said, but not exactly. That's what he says. I have a different idea. And that idea is the following. Give you an example, and we'll see what the vidui really means. And what vidui and Yom Kippur means too, and what confession means. If somebody gives me $1 million to take care of for him, a rich person wants me to take care of dispersing funds that he puts into my possession for dispersal. Okay? And he tells me who to give it to, and I do 100% what he said. I have to come back to him. I am accountable to him. He gave me $1 million. I have to come back to him after I disperse it and let him know that I did what he told me, that I dispersed it to people he gave it to disperse. Even if I did 100% everything, right? I can't just assume that everything's okay. I have to go back to him, and I have to account to him what I did with what he gave me. I'm accountable to him. That's the idea. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave me all these crops, and he told me 90%, 80% is yours. But 10% you have to give to this one, 10% you have to do this with. Right, I gave you 100%. It's all my giving you. You didn't get it on your own. You didn't make this tvua. I gave it to you. I made it rain. I made the seeds grow. I gave you the ground. I gave you the wherewithal. I gave you the seed. Not yours. It's mine. I gave it to you, 80% I told you you can use. 20% I told you what to do with it, who to give it to. You're accountable to come back to me and tell me that you did it. Even if you did everything right, you still have to confess to me that you are accountable. That's the confession. The confession isn't you do something wrong. The confession is, I am accountable. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave me my life. He gave me my body. He gave me my neshama. He gave me the things in the world that I can use. Even if I don't do anything wrong, I'm responsible to come back to him and say, Ribbono Shel Olam, you gave me a body. You gave me a neshama. You gave me food. You gave me clothing. You gave me air to breathe. You gave me everything. You told me what to do with it. I'm reporting back to you that I used it properly. Or, Rahmanul Litzlan, the opposite. I'm reporting back to you that I didn't use it properly. Whatever it is, good or bad, I'm accountable to confess to you my accountability. I can confess my accountability in a positive way and say I did what you told me to do, but I owe you that accountability, that confession. Or I can come along and say, Ribbono Shel Olam, I didn't do what you told me to do. I took the things that you gave me and I used them the wrong way. That's also a confession. But either way, I'm confessing my accountability. That's what confession is. It doesn't mean coming on Yom Kippur and saying I did something wrong. It means I'm accountable for all the things you gave me to give you an accounting if I used them wrong or right. So the confession can be, I did everything right, but I'm still accountable to you. Or I did everything wrong. Or something's wrong. Right? That's also part of the accounting. So at the end of the year, I'm responsible to give you an accounting. That's called confession. Sometimes the confession is a good accounting. Sometimes it's a negative accounting. But it's all a confession. I'm confessing my accountability to you. Okay, enough of that.
But nonetheless, we say al chet, we don't say al mitzvah, right?
Yes and no. Because we in our Yom Kippur prayers also mention the things that we did, the mitzvahs that we did, that the fact that you gave us a Torah or whatever, we do mention the fact that we are accountable even for the good things that we did. Okay, next. One thing more from the Sedra. Before we went into Eretz Yisrael, there were 11 blessings and 11 curses that were said publicly. Why these 11 specifically is Shaila. These are things that people can do privately, and therefore they had to be a curse because otherwise there's no incentive, right? Because you could hide and do these things. That's one opinion. There are other opinions. But the last one of them was the following. Orer asher lo yokim es divrei ha-Torah hazos lasos osa. Cursed is the person who will not observe or fulfill this Torah to do it. And there was a bracha. First said, Baruch Asher Yakim, blessed is the person who will fulfill the Torah. Now on the surface, that seems very, very harsh. Because on the surface, it seems to be a bracha to people who observe the Torah. And a terrible curse to people who don't fulfill the Torah. So anybody who doesn't do something in the Torah seemingly is being cursed. So nobody is exempt from that. Nobody is perfect. Nobody fulfills everything perfectly. So then, anybody who ever did an Aveira, did any sign of sin, is cursed also. But it's a tremendous curse. Besides the sin, besides the punishment for the sin, you have to also have this tremendous curse that was given when they came into Eretz Yisrael for anybody who doesn't fulfill the entire Torah. So therefore, the Mefarshim say, no, that's not what it's talking about. A person doesn't do a mitzvah, he does an Aveira, he'll get punished for what he does. But that curse is reserved for the following. One of two possibilities. First possibility. This is the way the Shari Tshuva learns it. The Shari Tshuva asks a question. It says, Kol she maiso merubi mechachmoso, chachmoso miskayemes. Whoever's deeds are greater than his knowledge will remain. But somebody who knows more than he does, then his knowledge won't remain. So the Shari Tshuva asks a very simple question. How can you do more than you know? You can only do what you know. How can your deeds be more than your knowledge? Says the Shari Tshuva, a person who doesn't know everything, but he says, look, I am willing to accept upon myself whatever I will learn, whatever the rabbis will tell me is incumbent upon me, I'm accepting upon myself. then he is accepting a responsibility, accepting his commitment, he's committing himself to the Torah. He's committed to everything. He may not know everything. Because he doesn't know, he may not do everything. But he's willing, well, Nasev Nishma, exactly, Nasev Nishma. I'm willing, Rabbanu Shel Olam, to commit myself to everything, now tell me what it is. And as I learn it, I'll do it. As soon as I make that commitment, it's as if I did everything. In fact, the Me'iri says, the Medrash says, what did the Me'iri? The Medrash says like this, it says that the Rabbanu Shel Olam told Moshe Rabbeinu to tell the Jewish people about the laws of Pesach 2 weeks before Pesach came. Immediately after he told them the halachas, it says, "Vayelchu vayasu b'nei Israel." They went and they did it. So the Medrash says they didn't do anything right away. 2 weeks later they did it. What do you mean they went and they did it? What'd they do? So since they accepted upon themselves to do it, they committed themselves to what they were told, it's as if they did it already. The Me'iri says, somebody who commits himself to repent his sins, even though he hasn't started doing it yet, he hasn't actually put it into practice, but he's committed, and he's going to do it. From the time he commits himself, he already changes his status. He's already considered a tzaddik, chosid. He'll have to work out the details. And that's the major idea of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. You can't change everything in 10 days, but you can commit yourself over the next year to work on it and commit yourself to make those changes. That is the idea of Asher Yokim, says the Shari Tshuva. A person not who observes the Torah, but a person who commits himself. He's Mekayim on himself to fulfill the Torah. La so so so. He commits himself to do it. That is what's called the Bracha. And somebody who doesn't commit himself to do the Torah, but fulfills everything, but without a commitment, he gets that curse. And therefore, if I were to ask you, who is a better Jew? Somebody who keeps 612 mitzvahs, but one mitzvah he doesn't accept. I don't believe in it, don't accept it, it's not incumbent on me, right? But I keep all 612, one I don't. Or somebody who keeps 100 mitzvahs, but he knows he's committed to keep all 613, except his Yetzer Hara gets the best of him. Can't control himself in this, can't control himself in that. He ends up keeping 100 mitzvahs out of 613. But he knows that he's going to get Gehenna for the mitzvahs he doesn't do and for the averus he does. He's committed. He knows he's doing something wrong. He accepts the fact that he's liable to it, but he just can't control himself. Who's a better Jew? The second one. Because the first one is doing it because he wants to do it. He didn't do it because God said, because God says 613. You decided to make a religion similar to Judaism. You committed yourself to 612, but one, you told God, forget it. So who makes the decision what you do? You. The other person says, God, I admit, I'm responsible for everything, and I know I'm going to get punished for not doing it. I'm just a weak person, I can't do it. But I'm committed, I know it's wrong. That's why, you know, there's the people who went to conservative temples, reform, and where they told them it's okay to drive on Shabbos, no problem, okay. Or people who drove to Orthodox shuls on Shabbos, plenty of places like that, right? Where when there's in out of, you know, the New York area in America, especially in the South, the people who went to frum shuls, right? Orthodox shuls weren't necessarily Shomer Shabbos. In many places, they kept the parking lot of the shul open on Shabbos. Some places, they closed the parking lot, so you parked a block away, right? South Africa, a lot of what's it called Jews, basically go to frum shuls, but they're not themselves Shomer Shabbos. What's the difference? Who's better? The one who knows he's doing something wrong, right? He goes to the Orthodox, he knows it's wrong to drive on Shabbos. He's not Shomer Shabbos. At least there's hope for him that maybe his children will become Shomer Shabbos. Maybe he'll change someday. Maybe he'll retire and become Shomer Shabbos. But the one who goes to the place where they tell him it's okay, you're not committed to that. It's okay to be Mechal Shabbos. There's no hope. So therefore, there's a special bracha for people who commit themselves to keep the Torah, whether they keep it or not. That's a separate thing. But at least a commitment. And somebody who refuses to commit himself to the Torah gets his curse. That's one way of understanding it. The second way is the following. Sometimes people think, this is what the Chassam Sofer says, that they're going to make the Torah kept better by transgressing the Torah, meaning the following. People sometimes think, if I could only do this prohibition, right, my observance of the Torah would be better. Right? This is the mistake that the conservative movement made in America. They, when they came to America, they assumed that real Torah observance in America can't be. It's going to die out. So they have to conserve what they can. So they said, if we don't allow people to drive to shul, they're moving out to the suburbs, they won't come to shul. So we'll tell them they can drive to shul, so more people come to shul. In addition, if we tell them they have to sit separate, men and women, they're not going to come to shul. But if we can tell them you can sit next to your wife, surely if you can sit next to somebody else's wife, right, that's an even more of an incentive to come to shul. So we'll take down the mechitza, but we're doing it l'shem shamayim. We're doing it for God's sake. We want more people to be in shul. We want more people to be able to come to shul. So we're going to tell people they can transgress things from the Torah, but it's for the sake of the Torah. On that, the Torah says, "Or Rasha lo yokim es divrei haTorah azos." Cursed is the person who won't fulfill what it says here, lasososo, thinking they're going to do it in order to make the Torah better, to make observance better. So they're going to relax various things, but and people can do that in their private lives too. Right? They can say, you know, I know that it's wrong to do this and this, but if I do it, I'll feel better about myself. I'll be a better Jew. I'll be able to keep other things better. So I'm just going to do this thing that's wrong because that's going to enable me to do more things that are right. What's the fallacy of that? Why isn't that a just philosophy? So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter gives the following marshal. Why it's not valid. He says that there were two kings. This is the way I heard the marshal. There's other ways of saying it, but it all boils down to the same thing. Two kings, King Reuven and King Shimon. And they met together. And King Reuven said to King Shimon, you know what? I love bets. I'm going to bet you $1,000,000 that I can get your prime minister, if you send him to my country, to undress publicly. So King Shimon said, there's no way in the world that my prime minister will undress publicly. Right? So I accept the bet. What are the conditions? He said, the conditions are the following. You have to send your prime minister to me for a week. Don't tell him anything about this bet. You can tell him anything else you want. Nothing about the bet. If in a week I can get him to undress publicly, you owe me $1,000,000. If I can't, I owe you $1,000,000. Okay, fine. So the prime minister, the king, King Shimon, calls in his prime minister. And he says, I'm sending you to King Reuven's land for a week. Do anything you want over there, except one thing. Do not undress publicly. Guy says, that's all you want me to do? I promise you, I was never considering it. I won't undress publicly. Fine. He goes to King Reuven's land. He's there for a day or two. King Reuven calls him in on the third day. And he says, you know, I've been observing you for the last 2-3 days. And you are one of the most astute statesmen I've ever seen in my life. You are really something special. And it's amazing to me that a hunchback like you could be such an astute statesman. He says, I thank you for the compliment, but I'm not a hunchback. He says, of course you're a hunchback. It's obvious you're a hunchback. Don't be ashamed. He said, but I never saw a hunchback who's such an astute statesman. I said, I'm not a hunchback. He says, you are a hunchback. He said, I'm so sure you're a hunchback, I'll bet you $500,000 that you're a hunchback. He says, this is ridiculous. He says, I know for sure I'm not a hunchback. This is an easy $500,000 to make. He says, well, how can I prove to you I'm not a hunchback? He says, only one way. I call in my entire court, and you get undressed in front of them. If they say you're a hunchback, you owe me $500,000. If they say you're not a hunchback, then I'll give you $500,000. The guy says, it's ridiculous. And then he remembers the king told him not to undress publicly. He said, but if the king would have known that I could make $500,000 by undressing, he surely wouldn't be upset. You know what? I'll take $250,000 for myself. I'll give him $250,000, and I'm sure he won't be angry with me. So he comes, they get the whole court in, he gets undressed. The court says, this guy's not a hunchback. King says, okay, I lose. Gives him $500,000. He runs back to his king and he says, look, before you get angry, I'm going to tell you what happened. I didn't listen to you. I got undressed publicly. But here's $250,000. The guy says, what did you do? He said, well, the king told me that if I get undressed publicly and prove that I'm not a hunchback, he'll give me $500,000. He said, you idiot. You didn't, if you give me the whole thing, you didn't gain me $500,000. You lost me $500,000. So all you saw was the gain of $500,000. You didn't see the loss of $1,000,000. So too, says the Reb Shlomo Salanter. Torah says you have to keep Shabbos. The God knows how detrimental it is for Michal Shabbos. What kind of destruction it causes in the world. Spiritual destruction, physical destruction, spiritual pollution. Here comes these people and say, well, if we let people be Michal Shabbos, there'll be more people in shul. It'll be good for God, right? More people are going to come to shul. He said, yeah, you see the benefit of the $500,000, but you don't see the loss of the million. The Rabban Shalom knew that too, and he didn't tell you, well, you could be Michal Shabbos if there'd be more people in shul. Why? Because the loss outweighs the benefit 1,000,000 times. So don't ever think that by going against the Torah you're going to benefit something, because you may see the benefit. You see the $500,000 benefit, but you don't see the $1,000,000 loss. You don't see what's behind that. And if the Rabban Shalom wanted it to happen, right, he would have told you this is an exception. But he didn't. So therefore, that's the idea. Or Rasher lo yokim es divrei haTorah zos. Cursed is the person who won't fulfill the Torah, lasososo, with the intention of building it up and keeping it. That's not a good philosophy. Because if the Rabban Shalom said you can't do it, that means that the loss always outweighs the benefit. Okay. That is what? Right. Don't think that you can outsmart the Rabban Shalom or know better than him. He knows better than you. Okay. The Chafetz Chaim says it even more poignantly. The halacha is that if you give somebody a present, you have to let them know you're giving them a present. He said, you know, the Rabban, you're trying to give God a present. You're trying to get more people into shul for God's sake. Right? Maybe God doesn't want your present. Ask him if he wants you to get more people in shul by them coming driving on Shabbos. Maybe he doesn't want that present. You can't give somebody a present. You have to let them know. First let God know that you're giving him a present. See if he wants it. Until he tells you he wants it, don't do him any favors. Do what he tells you to do. Don't try to do him extra favors. Okay. Next, we'll go back to last week's Sedra and 2 weeks ago Sedra, something to do with Elul. The month of Elul is both a preparation for Rosh Hashanah. 30 days before Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of Elul. So we always have 30 days before a holiday that we prepare for the holiday. It's also a 40-day process that culminates in Yom Kippur. 40 days where the 40 days of Moshe Rabbeinu was on Mount Sinai, the last 40 days where he, in the end, got the second tablets, the second luchos. And that 40 days was a process of tshuva, of slicha. It starts on Rosh Chodesh Elul, it culminates on Yom Kippur. So Elul is both a preparation for Rosh Hashanah and a beginning of a process that ends on Yom Kippur. Okay. There are many hints to the month of Elul that show us a little bit about what it's all about. One of the hints is Ani L'Dodi V'Dodi Li, the first letters of those words spell Elul, and there are many other hints. In last week's Sedra, there was a hint to the month of Elul that's a little obscure and needs explanation. It says that if you have you're in a battle and you capture a pretty woman and you want to live with her, so the Torah says you have to convert her first. And it tells you a whole process of how to convert her, and if after you convert her, you can then marry her. Okay? The Goyish lady goes through this quick process of conversion, right? Special halacha, it's not the regular conversion, special thing because of the immediacy of the wartime kind of Yetzer Hara that exists in a time of war. Okay. So the Torah says part of the process is that you give her 30 days to cry for her mother and her father. Bochsa esavia v'esima yerech yomim. Let her cry for her mother and father for 30 days. The Zohar Chodosh comments on that sentence, Zechodesh Elul. This is a hint to the month of Elul. This captive woman crying for her mother and father for 30 days is a hint to the idea of what Elul is all about. What does that mean? What do we cry for our mother and father for 30 days? What's the connection? In order to understand it, I want to go back two sedras. There's another hint to Elul. There's a hint to Elul in the parsha of Ore Niklat. Ore Niklat are cities of refuge, where if somebody kills somebody unintentionally, and not accidentally, but unintentionally, right? Negligent homicide. Okay? But today would be you pass on a blind curve, pass somebody in a car in a blind curve, and you end up killing somebody because of that, right? So you didn't do it on purpose. It wasn't premeditated murder, but it wasn't an accident either. You shouldn't have passed on a blind curve. So it's negligent homicide. You would have to run away to one of these cities of refuge and stay there till the Kohen Gadol dies, and then you can come out. But if you come out before that, one of the relatives of the victim is allowed to kill you. An avenger of the blood. As long as you stay in Ore Niklat, you're safe. Come out, you are at the mercy of the relatives of the victim. Okay, that's Ore Niklat. There's a hint to the month of Elul in this parsha, where it says in Parshas Mishpatim, in general, the Asher Lo Tzadot, speaking about murder. Somebody did not premeditate a murder. But God brought it to his hand, meaning it happened accidentally, unintentionally. I'll give you a place to run away to. The words in that sentence, Aleph Nun Hey, Liyado, Lamed Yud Dalet Vav, is Aleph Lamed, the first letters. Vesamti Loch, I'll give you a place to run away. Vav, Lamed is Elul. Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed, Elul. Somehow there's a connection between the cities of refuge and the month of Elul. What's the connection? So I always like to explain it in the following way. We're not talking again about accidental murder. We're talking about negligent murder. That means somebody had to be careless with somebody else's life. He did something that he could have been more careful, but he wasn't. Who could be negligent with his own life or with somebody else's life? Somebody doesn't appreciate how important life is. If you really appreciate how important life is, you'll be very, very careful not to kill somebody, right? Even by accident. And surely not to kill yourself. But if you don't really appreciate how important life is, then you can be negligent with life, right? You're not sensitive to how important it is, so big deal, so I'll pass on a blind curve. How important is life altogether, right? Subconsciously. I'm not thinking that consciously. But I don't really appreciate the value of life, so I'm taking a risk. You don't take a risk with something, right? If you have $1 million worth of diamonds, you don't take a risk that maybe it's going to, you know, what's it called, take it and hold it over the deck of a boat, maybe it's going to fall into the ocean. You don't take a risk with that. But if you have, you know, your garbage from yesterday, and so it falls into the ocean. If you appreciate the value, you don't take risks with it. If you don't appreciate the value, you can take a risk with something. The less you appreciate, the more of a risk. So only somebody who doesn't appreciate life can be negligent with his own or with somebody else's life. Okay. So how important is life? We're talking about life in this world, which is not forever. And how important is it? You know, we have a world to come. That's eternity. So how important is life in this world? So the truth is that there are two Mishnayos in Pirkei Avos. One seems to say life in this world is very important, and one seems to say life in this world is not important at all. One Mishnah says, Yofa Shoachas Shel Koras Ruach Ba'olam Haba Mikol Chayolam Azeh. 1 second of peripheral pleasure in the world to come is greater than all the pleasure that ever existed in this world. That makes this life in this world not too important. Compared to the next world, nothing. And yet there's another mission in Pirkei Avos that says, Yofa Shoachas Shel Tshuva Maisim Tovim Bolam Azeh Mikol Chayol Mabo. 1 second of repentance and good deeds in this world is greater than the whole next world. So which is it? Is this world more important or the next world more important? One Mishnah seems to say this world is very important. The other one seems to say, no, this world's not important at all. The answer is very simple. It depends what your perspective on this world is. If you have one perspective on this world, it's really worthless. And if you have a different perspective, it's eternally important. One of the two perspectives. So I'd like to give the, there's a secular perspective of life in this world and a Torah perspective. Very different. The secular perspective has many, many manifestations. But it all boils down to the same basic philosophy, which I saw on a t-shirt that they were selling in New York years ago. One sentence. The one who has the most toys when he dies wins. What does that mean? Toys are things or experiences that give you pleasure. When you're little, the toys are little. When you get bigger, the toys get bigger. Life begins when you're born. It ends when you leave this world. In between those two points in time, you're supposed to amass toys. Enjoy yourself. The one who amasses the most toys wins. He has a successful life. I was looking for an asterisk with a footnote when exactly you win at that point, since you're no longer here. And then I heard about a woman in Los Angeles who, before she died, put in her will that she be buried not in a casket, but in her Rolls Royce. And they fought it in court because the heirs did not want the Rolls Royce buried. They didn't care about the woman, but the Rolls Royce. And I said, they lost. And they buried her in a Rolls Royce. She had the biggest toy, the most expensive toy. She got to be buried in it. She won. If that is your philosophy of life, which is not our philosophy of life, we'll get to ours in a second. And that philosophy can have many ways. What are the toys? Sometimes you can have very refined toys. Some people, their toys are culture, the opera, good books, helping people, right? Going to the Peace Corps. Right? That's also a toy. If the purpose of it is, I enjoy that. That's what makes me feel fulfilled. Excuse me. If that's what your goal in life is, fulfill yourself. Be happy. So some people are happy by eating, you know, turkey legs and guzzling beer and whatever and other kind of pleasures. Some people are happy with very refined pleasures. But it all boils down to the same thing. I'm here in this world for my enjoyment and my pleasure here. Enjoy yourself. Get the toys before you leave. If that's what life is all about, then if you think about it, it's a very depressing life. Very depressing philosophy. Why? Because you can compare it to the following. Imagine a man standing outside the delivery room waiting for news of his wife's impending birth. And the doctor comes out and says, I have very sad news for you. Your wife just gave birth to a baby, but the baby was born with a terminal disease which it can't survive. Your baby is for sure going to die of the disease it was born with. So the man says to the doctor, Doctor, give me hope. There's a cure. No, there's no cure. You're looking for a cure. Now, he gave up long ago. Somebody survived this terrible disease miraculously without a cure. Never. He says, I never heard of such a terrible disease. There's no cure. You're not looking for one. Nobody ever survived this disease miraculously. What's the name of the terrible disease that my child was born with? He said, you see, when your kid was born, he contracted the disease called life. Some people survived 120, 80, 90. We don't know how long it's going to take. But one thing's for sure. Whoever contracted the disease called life when he was born died from it. Truth. If you know how many seconds you're going to live, we're all going to live 120 happy, healthy years. How many seconds in 120 happy, healthy years? So take 120, multiply it by 365, that's how many days in 120 years. Multiply that by 24, that's how many hours. Multiply that by 60, that's how many minutes. Multiply that by 60, that's how many seconds. Big number. Put it up in the delivery room on a digital display, and the moment you're born, push the button. What happens? The numbers start going backwards till zero. As soon as you're born, you start to die. If that's all that life is, the number of seconds between when you're born and when you die, and how much toys you can put in between that, then when you're born, you begin to die. But that's not our philosophy of life. Our philosophy of life is that life doesn't start when you're born. It doesn't end when you leave this world. Life is eternal. We were born, we were created as souls, and we lived as souls for thousands of years before we came into this world. And we're going to go out of this world and go back to a world of souls. Eternally. So then what do we have to come here for? Because God wanted to shower the ultimate pleasure on us eternally. a relationship with him. He wanted to shower himself on our souls. But he realized that if he would do that without us earning it, we wouldn't appreciate it as much as we would appreciate if we earned it. So God said, I'm not going to shower my goodness on you for free. I'm going to put your soul in a body, in a physical world, distanced from me. And I'm going to tell you how to connect to me instead of me connecting to you. You will do in this world things that will make your soul more like me, and then you'll have a relationship with me eternally. If you do things in this world that make your soul less like me, you have less of a relationship. You are the one who creates your eternity. That's what we're doing in this world. The purpose of this world is not an end in itself. It's a means to reach an end. And every single thing a person does in this world can either make his soul more godlike or less. Not only mitzvahs. Eating, drinking, sleeping, going on vacation. If you do it in a godly way, then your soul becomes more godly. If you do it in a less godly way, your soul becomes less godly. How do you know what's godly and what's not? We have a Torah that tells us those kinds of things that are godly and those kinds of things that are ungodly. And therefore, every second, a person can create more and more eternity. It says that there was a famous sinner who in the midst of a sin, something shocked him into repentance. And he repented so intensely that he died. And a heavenly voice went out, Ashrecha Reb Elazar ben Dordoi, de mezumen lolam haba. That you're fortunate that you've repented in 1 second and got your share of the world to come. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi heard this, he cried. And he said, Yesh kol na'olomo b'shoachas, it's possible for a person to acquire his world to come in 1 second. So it tells the Rosh Yeshiva, asked, what was he crying about? He should have been ecstatic. He can get your olam haba in 1 second. What's the cry about? He said, because you could do it every second. There's no limit. There's an infinite amount of eternities. Every second you can create more eternity. How many seconds do we let slip through our fingers? We don't do anything. So from a Torah standpoint, every second of life is potentially eternal. From a secular standpoint, no second of life is intrinsically valuable. Because if the whole purpose of life is to have pleasure in this world, how much pleasure can you have in 1 second? None. Can you eat a steak in a second? No. Can you watch a movie in a second? No. What can you do? Right? You can't earn. How much money can you earn in a second? So no second is important. What makes it important? If you have a lot of seconds. And another condition. It has to be quality of life. Because if you're 20 years old but you're in a coma in the hospital, your quality of life is close to zero. So what kind of pleasure could you have? What kind of toys could you have? Right? A heart-lung machine? What kind of toy is that? So what kind of pleasure can you have? So from a secular standpoint, in order for life to be important, you have to have quantity of life and quality. But no second in itself is intrinsically important. From a Torah standpoint, every single second of life in this world, on any level, even if you can only think, but you can do tshuva, you can think about mitzvahs that you fulfill by thinking, loving God, fearing God, in 1 second, you can create eternity. And every second you can do that. So from a Torah standpoint, this world is even more important than the world to come. Because this is where you create it. You can create more and more. And once you're there, they got what you got. That's it, finished. Can't make more. From a secular standpoint, this world is nothing. The world to come is infinitely greater than this world. Because it's short. How much pleasure can you have? And the pleasure in this world is nothing compared to the eternal pleasure of the world to come. Those are the two philosophies. Somebody who subscribes to the first philosophy. So life is not all that important. Because it's not really forever. Right? Eventually you're going to die. So if I pass on a blind curve and I end up killing myself or somebody else, how bad could it be? I didn't change anything. The guy's going to die anyway. And I don't know when. Maybe he was going to have a heart attack and die the next minute. So what did I do? Took a minute away from his life. A few seconds, no big deal. So it's not good, right? Killing somebody is not a good thing. But it's not like the end of the world because I didn't change anything. I just made it happen sooner than it was going to happen anyway. And I don't know how much sooner because who knows what was going to happen to that guy. So if you think about it, it's not all that terrible. But if I subscribe to the second philosophy and every second of life in this world has the potential of eternity, then if I took away 1 second, I took away eternity. So who could be derelict with somebody else's life or with his own life, people who don't appreciate what life is really all about, that life is a preparation for eternity, not just having toys in this world. So therefore, we take that person and we rehabilitate him. We re-educate him. You weren't familiar with how important life is. We're going to show you how important life is. Usually people think that this world is all there is because they're settled here. So we're going to unsettle you. We're going to take you out from where you're settled and put you in a place where you're unsettled. So you realize you're not here forever. This is not the place where you're going to remain forever. This is only temporary. We're going to put you in a place where you feel temporary. It's like the person who came to the Chofetz Chaim, rich American businessman, wanted to visit the Gadol Hador, the Chofetz Chaim, came to his little hovel. He had a little table, a bed, some chairs. So this guy walked into the house of this great rabbi, and he couldn't hold himself back. He exclaimed, "Where's your furniture?" Chofetz Chaim looked at him. He says, "Where's your furniture?" He said, "I'm only visiting here. I don't bring my furniture with me." Chofetz Chaim said, "I'm also visiting here. I'm bringing my furniture. My furniture is in the next world. In this world, I'm only visiting." So we take the guy out of his feeling of this is the place where you're set, and we make him unsettled. Make him go into Galus, to exile. Then as he's running there, there's signs up all over the place how to get to Ari Miklat, that we should get there fast and not be killed by the relative of the victim. And it's a halacha, you have to have these signs. And they can't say, you know, yashar, yashar. We're talking about real directions, right? Go, what's it called, you know, 50 feet, like a GPS, you know, it tells you exactly where to make the turn and whatever. So the guy says, "Wow, God's so concerned about my life? Is it just a matter of toys? What's God concerned? Must be life is very important." Then finally he gets to the Ari Miklat. Who lives there? The Levium. Spiritual people. Now I see what life is all about. And when is he fully rehabilitated? When the Kohen Gadol, who is the main spiritual life of the Jewish people, dies. Because when do you really appreciate the Kohen Gadol? When he's dead. Right? While he's alive, yeah, okay, Kohen Gadol. But when the Kohen Gadol dies, that's when art school writes their books and everybody says, "Has paid them," and then you know who the Kohen Gadol is, right? So, a whole year, we are guilty of negligent suicide. Because we let seconds pass through our fingers and we don't do anything with it. So basically killing ourselves. We're dealing in a very negligent way with our own lives. So you need a month in the year before Rosh Hashanah, before you can be judged on your life. And if you come to God and say, "Zochreinu l'chayim, God, give me more life." God has the right to turn around and say, "Could you define the term? What exactly do you want? Another steak? Another movie? What exactly? Another dress? What exactly do you want? You want life? Tell me what it is." So if it's another toy, maybe God's not interested. But if life is the ability to create eternity, God's interested in that. That's why we say, Zochreinu l'chayim, melech chofetz b'chayim. The kind of life you want, Ribono shel Olam, for me. V'chosveinu b'sefer ha'chayim l'mancha Elokim chayim. So God says, you're on the same page. I want that also, so why shouldn't I give it to you? So before we are judged for our lives and we ask for life, we need a month to get a perspective on how important life is and what life is all about. That's the connection between Elul and the cities of refuge. Elul is a city of refuge in time. That's why when the Torah says we should be holy people, holiness means leading your life not like an animal that's just for the sake of this world. Eat, drink, be merry. That animals do that. But be holy means use this world, eat, drink, be merry. But not for the sake of this world alone, for a higher purpose. For the sake of, I'm eating so I can have the strength to serve the Ribono shel Olam so I can get Olam Haba. And so on. All the things that you do in this world, I'm doing for a higher, more noble purpose, not just to fill my stomach. That's called Kedusha. Immediately after the Torah says, Kedoshim to you, gives me two mitzvahs. Let's call Ish Ovi the Imo Tiro, honoring a parent and keeping Shabbos. Why? Because those two things represent what this world is all about. First, Kibbut Avoim. Honoring your parent means you appreciate life. Because your parents gave you life in this world. If you don't honor your parents, that means you don't appreciate the life they gave you. If you honor them, it means you do appreciate the life they gave you. What is the reward for honoring a parent? Long life. Why? Because if I honor my parents, that means I appreciate life. I should get more of it. If I don't honor my parents, I don't appreciate the life they gave me. So honoring a parent means I appreciate life in this world, and my parents gave me that, and therefore I appreciate them. But life in this world is important because it's Shabbosai, because it's a Shabbos, because Shabbos is like the world to come. You're supposed to use this world to create the world to come. So those two mitzvahs go together. Parent, honoring a parent, and keeping Shabbos. Those are the two foundations of appreciating life in this world, but the right, for the right purpose. Keeping Shabbos, meaning looking towards the world to come. It says this, now let's go back to the captive woman. Captive woman cries for her parents, says Ibn Ezra, two reasons. One reason is she may never see them again. She doesn't know, maybe they were killed in the battle. Even if they weren't killed, she's miles and miles away from them in this house that is Jew. So she may never see them again. It's proper, it's honor for a parent, even a goy, to cry for them. Maybe they're dead. Maybe I won't see them. A person has to honor his parents. Even a goy has to honor their parents because they gave you life. So one reason she cries for her parents is a sign that she appreciates the life that they gave her. Second reason, says the Ibn Ezra, she's crying for a different reason. She now is on the road to becoming a Jew. She sees what a beautiful life, a spiritual life is, not just for the sake of this world. She's crying that her parents didn't have that opportunity, that her parents didn't have a chance to convert. They didn't, never were made aware of this beautiful Jewish life that she was made aware of. She's crying for her parents because she appreciates the physical life, and she's crying for her parents because now she appreciates the purpose of that physical life for the spiritual. That's Elul. Elul is this idea. Right, 30 days, appreciate life in this world in light of what its real purpose is as a means to create eternity. Because you're going to come Rosh Hashanah and be judged for your life and ask for life. Before you do that, get a good perspective of what life is all about. That's the month of Elul. Okay. Yes. Right. It's not what's it called one Hashem Mitzinoach, but there are certain things that a person has to do because Seichel tells you to do it. It's not a mitzvah per se, but it's besides Hashem Mitzinoach, anything. It says even before the Rabbanim Shem told them they can't steal. The Ramban says they should have known with Seichel you don't steal. You can't have a society if you steal. That's why they were punished by the Dor HaMabul for stealing, even though they weren't yet commanded on it. Because there's certain things that the seven mitzvahs of Noah are commandments, but they're also logical things that people should know for the betterment of society, most of them. Right, so anything that's seichel dik, right, being Hakaras HaTov, the Torah didn't make it a specific mitzvah, but something that a normal thinking person has to do.